I think it's safe to say we have all been obsessed with something at one point or another. But have you ever had to explain your obsession to your friends and family and struggle to make them understand because it was so far and beyond the scope of the world you shared with them? For Benjamin Boas, it was his obsession towards Japanese video games, manga, and anime that brought him all the way from Connecticut, USA, across the world to Japan, where he didn't speak the language and didn't know a soul. And later, all those times he spent as a teenager trying to explain to his parents or grandma some of the most twisted plots of the latest anime he was into, that would become the key element to landing a job his teenage self couldn't even dream of. I'm Kaori Halevi, and you're listening to Global Citizens of Japan, a podcast that explores identity, belonging, culture, and language with multicultured and multilingual people of Japan. Benjamin, to me, is the ultimate nerd in the best way. As you will find out, once he sets his mind on something, he throws himself into it with an overwhelming level of intensity, dedication, and obsession. Today, he is a translator, lecturer, and the author of two books. He works with governments, companies, and universities, and was even a Cool Japan ambassador appointed by the Japanese government until the program ended just recently in July 2022. But he will be the first person to tell you all the things that were not so cool about the Cool Japan campaign, despite all the potential he saw in it. He even published an article about it in a monthly magazine published by the Studio Ghibli, and it was his honesty about the campaign that got him the ambassador position. We will also talk about how his teenage dreams came true when he was actually paid to watch thousands of hours of anime, or the time when he was hired to train a Hollywood actor, Aikido, a form of martial art, for a major American television series. Benjamin Boas was born in New York City and grew up in Fairfield County, Connecticut. He was raised Jewish and attended elementary school and Jewish day school.
We kept kosher at home. We had two different sets of silverware, one for meat, one for dairy. We celebrated the major Jewish holidays, Rosh Hashanah dinners, Shabbat dinners. Chanukah was always something that me and my sisters looked forward to. Pretty much all of my friends were Jewish. We knew a couple of other families in town who were not, but since the only school I knew until I was in seventh grade was a Jewish day school, all my friends, at the very least, knew some Hebrew, certainly celebrated the holidays. Some of my friends were particularly Orthodox, so when I would go over to their houses on Fridays, we had to stop using electricity, not cook food, that sort of thing, until the following evening. So I guess you could call that my first intercultural experience.
Benjamin's first exposure to Japan was when he was 4 years old.
My first exposure to Japan has to be Super Mario Brothers, playing that on the Nintendo Entertainment System that my mom and I got for my dad in Father's Day 1987, 1988, which I'm not sure he ever actually played himself, because once I figured out what it was, I played it more than anyone else in my household. I love bringing this up in lectures that I give about Japan's popularity abroad at universities here in Japan, that the person who first introduced Japanese culture to me was very much an Italian man who worked as a plumber for a living, which, they're surprised to hear about until they see the picture of Mario, because if everyone knows Mario.
And you didn't know it was from Japan or...
Oh, no, I think I was four at the time, so I didn't really know anything about the idea of foreign cultures. I knew about Hebrew, because I had been learning Hebrew since I started going to kindergarten, so it would have been at about the same time, but I didn't know what Japan was. There weren't Japanese people around.
A few years later, it would be video games that would prompt Benjamin to learn Japanese. In 1990, he discovered the game Final Fantasy. He zipped through versions 1 to 3, and while seeking the next version, he discovered that there were actually more versions that were only being released in Japan.
So around when I hit puberty, I wanted to play another one of these games, but they didn't exist in the English language market, but I knew that if I could somehow get my hands on a Japanese language version of them, I could play it if I could play it in Japanese. So that got me thinking about trying to actually learn the language. And late in high school, when I was a junior, I actually got serious enough about it to the point where I wrote up, with the help of my parents, a petition to my principal to give me credit for studying Japanese. I found a Japanese language instructor in New Haven, in the area of my high school, just basically wrote up this whole proposal, basically saying, look, you know, I found the teacher, you know, give me credit for the classes and like give me a classroom space. And the principal said yes. So in my senior year of high school, I studied Japanese language at the school. I think it was the first time the school ever had Japanese language classes, like ever. And it was so that I could play, you know, the extra Final Fantasy games, you know, because I had no other choice, right? Like, I really, really, really wanted to play those games, and there was no way to play them in English at the time.
It was in high school that Benjamin would also discover manga and anime, due largely to the fan culture that existed back then, an era before Japanese anime content was widely available online in the US as it is today.
I think the first manga I ever got my hands on was the English language version of Rama One Half, or Rama Nibun no Ichi, that I spotted at summer camp, and it must have been sometime around 1998. And even though it was the first time I ever had my hands on a Japanese language comic book, there was something about it that seemed familiar to me, probably because I had been exposed to similar motifs and similar drawing styles and similar stories and all those video games that I had played. So when I pick up this comic book that features like a martial artist, you know, battling with monsters, I'm like, oh, you know, I've seen these sorts of monsters before. I battled them myself in like Final Fantasy. Oh, you know, this guy's just like me. So I got pretty into Ranma when I was in high school. Every time a new English language version of it came out, you know, I would order it through, you know, this new website called Amazon. And then around the same time, I started hearing about the visual form of, or the animated form of manga, you know, then called this exotic world called anime. And back in the day, anime wasn't really known as a successful product. Like, you could get Rama tapes and Blockbuster, but there were only like two or three of them. The real way to get your hands on anime, if you were wanted to get into it, was to rely on these things called fan subs, which were fan-created subtitles of original Japanese anime video cassettes. People would get these originals, like hardcore fans would get these originals from Japan. In fact, I've read that the hardcore anime fans would like do this barter arrangement where they would send Star Trek tapes over to Japan for fans over there who wanted to get their hands on Star Trek, because Star Trek over there was apparently as hard to get as anime was in the United States. So the super hardcore fans would get the anime originals, and because they were so hardcore, they would have like their one Japanese language capable friend create a script for them that they would then burn onto as subtitles themselves, and then copy a bunch of tapes and kind of send them out to like the larger anime fan community. This is something that's worth its own deep dive, but anime's popularity around the turn of the millennium in America didn't just happen by itself. It happened because there was already this nationwide network of anime fans that had been basically supplying each other, well, contraband for so many years that when something legitimate finally hit the market, they're like, oh, now I can actually go out and buy this thing. You know, with the advent of really DVDs and the internet, the fandom had existed long before that. So when a high school kid like me in the 1990s was like, oh, you know, I really like this Rama thing. Is there anything else like it? You know, my somewhat nerdy friend in high school was like, oh yeah, you know, I got these anime tapes for you. I'll loan them to you. You know, because you had to loan them, right? Like, it's not like nowadays you can just copy a file. So thanks to that friend, I got my first look at Kimagure Orange Road. What was popular at the time? Ninja Scroll, Vampire Hunter D, Akira. I think Akira I was able to rent from Blockbuster. I mean, I very quickly rented everything that Blockbuster had in anime. And, you know, when I went to my local Barnes & Noble, I cleared out their manga shelf. You know, it was only a shelf, not even a bookcase. Now you'll have entire sections devoted to the medium. But back then, it was like nothing. And, you know, similar to, like, my story with the missing Final Fantasies, I quickly learned that if I wanted to read more of this stuff, I would have to get the original, because it took so long for it to get translated into English, and only a small part of what was out there had been translated. So, like, throughout all of high school, I was really aware that there was, like, more of what I loved, but it wasn't wasn't where I lived, and it wasn't in the language that I spoke. So if I really, really wanted to get into it, I would have to go over there, and I would have to learn the other language. So that's what I wound up doing.
Just going back on the fan subs thing, that was like a total labor of love, basically, right? Of just fans, because they wanted to spread like the English versions.
That's absolutely right. And you saw it a lot in internet culture in like the 90s and the 2000s, like people who were really, really into something and they just wanted to make it accessible for other people who are also into it. And I mean, what they wound up doing was, of course, not legal at all, but they justified it themselves, you know, correctly or not, by saying, well, there was no legal product available at the time. So it was either do this or have nothing out there. Now it gets a little bit more complicated. But back then, it really was like, it wasn't get your hands on the fan sub because then it's free. It was get your hands on the fan sub because that's the only way to watch more of this stuff. And it's funny because you see it in like similar things in otaku culture here in Japan, like the comic market, you know, where people are selling doujins, you know, basically mock-ups of existing commercial products, but they only want to sell it to other fans.
Yeah.
Like, it's not to get rich. I mean, some circles do get rich there. But the majority of the people who go up there don't do it to make a profit. They do it because they really, really love the series. And they really, really want to engage with other people who love the series. The comic market takes place between the 2 and 3 times a year at Tokyo Big Sight. And it's like the biggest nerd event in the whole country. Uh-huh. Over the 3 days that it's run, it generally attracts over 500,000 attendees, usually 600,000. So it's one of Tokyo Big Sight's biggest events. And Tokyo Big Sight is a major convention center, and it's entirely volunteer run by geeks.
Wow.
So it's like a non-for-profit venture that has this interesting relationship with the publishing industry, because pretty much everyone who goes there goes to set up a little booth to, like, you know, show off what they've created about their favorite series. And, you know, it's clearly copyright infringing. I mean, I know I'm saying this into a microphone, but, like, everyone knows that because they're using depictions of their favorite characters are copyright protected. But because they're not selling them on the open market, and they're only selling them in this event called Komike, the comic market, everyone kind of looks the other way. Partially because it's by fans for fans, and also partially because some really good artists have come up through Komike. They use Komike as kind of this way of, like, developing these basic professional skills. And, like, industry representatives go to Komike as well, so it's almost like the minor leagues of baseball. Yeah, it's scouting. But the environment itself is just really, really, really cool, because it's all, like, the people all over Japan who are just super into something. And, you know, because it's run by serious otaku, when you go in, you can have this huge map that depicts, you know, where every single stall is, you know, out of all the...
Handwritten?
Yeah, well, not handwritten, but it was probably hand-designed. You know, there's, like, 5,000 booths, and you have to, like, use a grid to, like, determine which one you want to go to. But when you go to, they're there. Like, it's really cool. It's really thanks to that sort of thinking that I was able to get over here, like, at all. Like, I wouldn't have gotten into Japan if there hadn't been that sort of, you know, gray area, gray zone availability of content that I could at least at first see and be like, oh, I really like this. Oh, I really want to get into this.
So how did Benjamin get over to Japan? After he exhausted all the Japanese learning opportunities in the U.S., including 2 summers in the intensive Japanese program at Middlebury College, where CIA operatives are also trained, he secured a summer internship at one of the largest human resources companies in Japan, despite having zero interest in becoming a salaryman. Anything to come to Japan and continue learning Japanese. A Fulbright fellowship in 2007 is what allowed Benjamin to start living in Japan. In 2015, he co-published his first comic book with illustrator Chika Aoyagi about how he learned Japanese language and culture through manga and video games. And this opened the door to new opportunities.
If you tell everyone that you're really, really into something and you really, really get into it, you know, watch out, because you might get what you wish for, which is what happened to me. Shortly after I published my own manga in February 2015, I got contacted by this very, very large media company that puts out a lot of movies on the internet. And we'll just say that their name rhymes with Petsticks. And I wound up as Pet Sticks' first bilingual writer in any language, because they really, really needed someone to be able to write descriptions of the Japanese language videos that they were putting on their service. Not so much because it was hard to find someone to translate Japanese into English, but because they needed highly contextual descriptions. Because the variety of anime and really the variety of movies that you will find in Japan, I think it's fair to say that it exceeds the variety that you will find in Hollywood. Like, there is just some stuff out there that is super, super weird. Like, one series called Akagi involves a teenager who gets involved with the Japanese underworld because he is a prodigy at playing the gambling game of Mahjong. And the story culminates in this life-or-death battle where he goes up against one of, like, Japan's hidden power titans, like this old guy in his 80s, and they wound up wagering their own blood against each other. Like, they're not playing for money. Like, they each have, like, IVs hooked up to their arms, and each time one of them loses, like, they get more blood drawn from them. And, you know, like, how do you wrap that up in, like, a two-sentence, you know, like,
impossible.
Tweet? Right? Well, it's possible. It's possible. But you can't do it the same in Japanese and English. It has to be a fresh writing in order to be, like, catchy enough to you know, get a fan's eye. Be like, oh, you know, hey, that sounds cool. You know, like, the average Japanese person, maybe they don't play Mahjong, but they know what it is, and they're familiar enough with gangster tropes to be like, oh, yeah, someone bets their own blood. Yeah, I mean, okay. You know, you would expect that sort of thing in a gangster movie. Whereas if you try to explain it to Americans, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, it's kind of like Mahjong, but it's more like poker. And yeah, they're actually like wagering bodily fluids. And, like it doesn't work that way. Like, you have to talk about different things. You have to approach it from an entirely different perspective.
Yeah.
And that's all I had been doing because, you know, for years and years, I had to explain my obsessions to like my family and my friends, you know, people who were not into it as much as I was. So I had years and years of experience of like using normal words to describe things that were just not normal at all. And then it wound up being my job. So for, you know, this company, I must have watched over 1,000 anime movies, like all these different series, in order to figure out what happened so that I could then write an English language description that was appealing to a general member of their user base. So basically, like a typical American was kind of who we wrote for. Just looking at the Japanese descriptions was never, ever sufficient, you know, partially because they just weren't worth translating. Like, they wouldn't appeal to an American. And also because they were often for fans. So like in Comic-A, like the comic market that I just talked about, it's this entire by fans, for fans culture, which is really, really good if you're looking for other people with the same obsessions of you. But if you want to sell something, you don't want to aim at people who are already going to buy it. You want to aim at people who would buy it if they knew about it, but don't know about it. Like, you want to increase, you know, your customer base, the blue ocean strategy. And so if you take that sort of thinking and you apply it to descriptions, writing a description that fans love is probably the worst thing that you can do,
right?
Because the fans are going to watch it anyways. Like, it does. Like, you could have no description and the fans are going to watch it because they know what they want already. So you actually need to make the description almost totally the opposite of that, as something that allows someone who knows nothing about, you know, blood mahjong, or, you know, like, boy gets splashed with water and turns into girl, invaders come in from the sky and threaten to take over Earth unless the American, or unless the Earth's champion can beat them in a game of tag, which is the plot of Urusei Yatsura.
Spoiler alert.
Well, no, it changes a little bit after that, but like, you have to aim at people who would never otherwise be interested in these sorts of things and try to be like, oh yeah, hey, you know, like, oh, I wonder what Japanese people think aliens look like. Oh, you know, that might be cool. Or like, oh, like a Japanese gangster thing that also involves board games. Oh yeah, I guess I'll try that. Once they click, you know, then they'll probably watch it because the stuff that Japan puts out on the whole is good. But getting them to the point where they can click, or getting them to the point where they feel like, oh, I can watch Japanese stuff, that's actually quite tough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that involved me staring at a screen for thousands of hours, you know, doing what, you know, I could only dream of being able to do for pay as a teenager. It's, you know, like being paid to watch anime, you know, being paid to watch Japanese stuff and then write about it. It sounds like the coolest job in the world. And honestly, it was pretty cool, but like doing it, it becomes a job.
In the same year that Benjamin got the job of his teenager self's dreams, he had another surreal business opportunity. He was approached by one of the largest animation studios in Japan.
At the end of 2015, the same year I put out that comic, I was also asked by Studio Ghibli, of all places, you know, the Totoro animation studio, to write an essay for their monthly magazine. Studio Ghibli has a monthly literary magazine. It is called Nebbu, which means hot air, which in Italian is Ghibli or Ghibli. That's why they call it Nebbu. They were making their essay, that particular issue, focused on cool Japan, which is like this buzzword in Japan about unexpected interest in the country by foreigners, particularly Westerners. Since I had just put out a book about that very thing, you know, surprise, surprise, this nerd is really into anime and video games, you know, enough that he put out his own comic. They asked me to write about it, and I remember meeting with the editor and being like, well, you know, if you want me to write about cool Japan, I would love to write about it because I've become familiar with government programs to produce Japanese culture content abroad, but like, I'd rather write about what I really think about it. And they're like, oh, well, it's funny that you say that because we were actually looking for just criticism. Like, we want someone to really critique it. But, you know, if you're not comfortable doing that, then, you know, we can find someone else. I'm like, no. I want to critique it. You know, not because I think that Japan isn't cool. I mean, Japan is awesome. Like, if I had to pick the coolest country in the world, I would pick Japan. It's not to say that everyone has to, but, you know, it's pretty up there. But there's a difference between, you know, a fan like me being like, hey, I think this is cool, and, like, a bunch of Japanese officials being like, Japan is officially cool, you know, to their own country. Like, it looks ridiculous. And this sort of, like, self-congratulatory stuff was a lot of what I saw about the official cool Japan-related entities. There was this, like, cool Japan show on Japan's public broadcaster that was just embarrassingly self-congratulatory. I mean, no offense to the people who work on it, but it was obviously meant more for a Japanese audience than it was for actual fans of Japan. And, you know, I wound up assigned to write this 10-page essay about cool Japan stuff, and I handed in, like, 15 pages, and they published them all. Paid me extra for it, even. They're very, very nice about it. But the title of my essay was Cool Japan Is Not Cool. And I felt a little bit bad about writing it because I love Japan and I love the Japanese government, you know, for all, you know, their, you know, good parts and bad parts. And I really don't like the idea of criticizing something for the sake of criticizing it. Like, everything has its own faults, particularly government programs. Like, no government program is going to be perfect. And with the way that bureaucrats' work is set up, like, everything has to be systemized to the point where it's always going to be a little bit ridiculous. I mean, it's how it works. Like, they don't have that much freedom. So I didn't want to seem like I was just, you know, ragging on them. So I went and I made appointments with the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, and with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, to the two ministries which are basically responsible for the stuff that I critiqued. And I went in and I said, you know, I've published this. I think it was on the day that it was published. Like, you know, here I am. I'm right here. I'm showing this to you. If I got anything wrong, tell me.
Wow.
You know, if you want me to explain anything more, I'm happy to. Like, I just want things to get better. I'm not trying to say that anyone's doing a bad job. And, you know, to my delight, they wound up being like, oh, thank you. Because the people on the ground already knew all of the stuff I had pointed out. So, like, none of this is a surprise to them that, you know, a significant chunk of what they were doing was just, you know, very unfortunately inwardly facing. They already knew that. But their bosses, because they were, you know, a few levels removed from the actual practical application of these policies, their bosses were often unaware. And with Japanese hierarchies being as strict as they are, it's very difficult for the people on the bottom to critique the people on the top. But what they can do is they can say, hey, boss, this foreign guy who put out a book, he's critiquing the program. Maybe we should listen to what he says. So I was very happy to hear this. I apparently did a service to these guys because I was able to write down what they were secretly thinking and package it in a way that they could show it to their own bosses without getting into trouble.
Prestigious publication.
Oh, yeah, like Studio Ghibli. But one really surprising thing of that is that a few months after that, they were like, you know, Boaz-san, we know that you don't love the Cool Japan program, so we don't think that you'll say yes to this, but, you know, we're allowed to nominate new ambassadors for the Cool Japan program, and we want to nominate you. And I'm looking at this, and I'm like, oh, man, because I think that if you criticize something without offering to help, then you really haven't done anything. Like, it's not enough to say you're doing a bad job. You have to say this is what you should do. And even beyond that, you have to say, well, you know, I'm criticizing it because I want to help it be better. So that's the position I was in. And then I was given an opportunity to actually help it myself, so I can't say no. So the very program which I had been making fun of, like, my friends for years, like, oh, you know, what country calls themselves cool, I then became an official ambassador for. So I am still a Cool Japan ambassador. I think I am officially one for another 20 days when they end the program after, you know, it's 6 years of existence. And I am very proud to say, and I'm so happy to be recorded here, that I believe I am the only Cool Japan official ambassador out of, like, the 50 that they have who actually goes around Japan and the world giving lectures about Cool Japan. I will go and I will use this title to try to explain to people what I think are the important issues, like the stuff that I've spoken about, you know, in this podcast, which is about the importance of having this middleman in between the wonderful, like, content and products and culture that this country has and the outside world, which would love all of this stuff if only someone could explain it in a way that used very, very simple words.
Yes, in their language.
Right, in their language. And it's just very, very hard to find anyone who can do both of them. I mean, I certainly can't. I'm not a master level craftsman, but I can at least explain things in a way that, like, you know, my grandma can understand. And that's really important. And that's almost always, like, the missing component in any one of these Cool Japan efforts is someone who can step up and say, you're like, you know, can people in other countries really understand what we're doing? In my 6 years as a Cool Japan ambassador, I have tried to be that guy. I show up to the official meetings. I'm one of very few ambassadors who even shows up. I think it's like me and like one or two other people. But I am definitely the only one who has raised his hand in the middle of one of these official pro forma meetings and been like, don't you think you should change the name? I have a video of this because I wanted to make sure I could prove that I did it. But I raised my hand and I was like, you know, if we're talking about exciting things to happen for the Cool Japan program for the next year, how about you change the name? Because no one likes the name outside of Japan.
But we'll see how that goes.
Oh, I mean, they almost certainly won't. And I didn't say it in order to honestly make them change it. I said it so that there was some awareness in the room that people are really watching. And being cognizant of the foreign perspective really, really is important. If people want to do anything meaningful, which is the only reason I'm involved. Mm-hmm. So in all honesty, it was my hope that I would say these sorts of criticisms, very reasonable criticisms, but criticisms so much that they would fire me. So to a certain extent, I'm kind of disappointed that the program is coming to an end before I could, you know, get in trouble for telling the truth. But now that the program has ended, they are starting up a related program called the Cool Japan Producers, which I will send in an application for. And if I'm accepted there, I will continue to do my best to try to put Japan together with, you know, an international pipeline. But to continue saying what I think to the point where if I get in trouble for it and fired, I will proudly tell everyone about, you know, that time when the Japanese government got rid of me because I was being too honest.
While it was video games and manga that initially brought Benjamin to Japan, he became deeply immersed in Aikido, a form of martial art, and Zen meditation.
I initially was really into the geeky stuff and had no interest and frankly no aptitude in martial arts or with meditation. But after having worked in Japan for a little while in like the research industry as an academic researcher on gambling of all things, for whatever reason I just kind of got sick of it. I was in such a niche field that I was like the only person who was capable of writing about it in native English. Like I still think I'm the only serious mahjong player in Japan with experience in an academic institution. There's one, and native English ability. There's one other native English speaker who's far, far better than me, but he is not interested in publishing research about what he did. Amazing guy, he's just not an academic. But I used to be, and it frustrated me because I could tell that no matter what I wrote, it would be lauded because it's like, hey, look at how international we are. We put out this English language stuff, and I wanted to be challenged because I knew that what I was putting out wasn't as good as what I expected myself to be. It's for better or for worse. So in one of the most, I think, extraordinary decisions of my life, I dropped out of this amazing scholarship that I had at one of the best universities in the country in order to join a martial arts dojo. So I spent 1 year at the Yoshinkan Aikido, a main Honbu dojo, studying martial arts with the police. And then concurrent to that, I started spending a lot of time at this big Zen Buddhist temple, just trying out meditation. And in both of these things, I didn't think that I would get particularly good at them. And frankly, I don't think I'm any good at them them now. I just wanted to see what would happen if I did something that I could fail at. Because it seemed like with the academic stuff, no matter what I did, I was told I was a success. And I just got sick of that. I wanted to be told I was a failure. So I tried doing the two things that I was pretty sure I would fail at. At the time, I would go to the dojo like every day and, you know, have the cops kind of like snicker when I tried to do the moves. Because I was really bad at it. And, you know, the cops all had experience. I mean, they were nice guys. Like, I honestly look ridiculous. Like, this is not me complaining about how I was treated. I was really bad. I'm still pretty bad now, but like, I was really, really bad back then. And I kind of half expected to be kicked out any day. And for whatever reason, they just, you know, they let me graduate. You know, I got a black belt. And since then, for both that and for the Zen meditation, I've put in efforts to try to help other people go into these environments, which I thought were quite helpful to me. So I've run a number of martial arts related events for like the American University community in Tokyo. And then for, I think, almost 10 years, I was running these monthly bilingual Zen meditation events down in Kamakura, which you once yes. came to. And I stopped doing those once I had kids, but I still do the occasional event. My family ran two iterations of Zen for Moms, as we called them. It was not only for moms, but it was geared towards mothers because we had babysitters. We work with the temple to give us a spare room, and you know, we hired local babysitters so that moms with young kids could not only come and do a nice meditation session, but they also wouldn't have to worry about their kids at the time, which is honestly something I've never heard of anyone else ever putting together. And, you know, a lot of credit to these monks for letting us do it, because I think we really filled a niche. And then another thing that I'm doing right now that I'm very excited about is in early September, the temple and I are going to welcome 25 Ukrainian refugees. I was fortunate enough to get in contact with the embassy, who is in contact with this amazing volunteer up in Saitama, who I believe she works with this Ukrainian church, which runs multiple events for refugees like a week. I mean, I don't know where they find the time to do it. But when I was like, you know, do you think anyone might want to come down to Kamakura? She's like, sure. We put together a little event description. She puts it up on Facebook and 25 people sign up in 15 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. So that'll be real exciting. I think that if 25 goes well, then we can do a much bigger one later on. And, you know, hopefully give these folks a nice time before hopefully they're able to go home, you know, sooner rather than later.
That one intensive year of learning Aikido shoulder to shoulder with Tokyo cops would lead to an experience of a lifetime for Benjamin when he contributed to a major Hollywood production.
Back in 2009, I wrote for this really cool blog called Mutant Frog Travelogue, which is started by a buddy of mine named Roy Berman, who I knew from summer camp. Around 2009, this guy named Jake Edelstein was just starting to make headlines as this, you know, American former crime reporter for a newspaper who, you know, was threatened with death by the criminal gangs. And I saw him, I think, on like The Daily Show being like, I want more press that the gangs, you know, have a harder time assassinating me. I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'll email him. So I email him and I'm like, well, you said that you wanted more press. I'll give you more press. I'll interview you for my blog. And he's like, okay. So I wound up doing this two-part interview with him about gambling, because that's what I was really into at the time. And, you know, ever since then, we've kind of been in contact off and on. We put together this fundraiser for an anti-human trafficking organization, An Evening with Jake Edelstein, and I think May 2010. And the end of 2019, I got this phone call out of the blue with him, you know, saying that he needed a martial arts instructor in a particular martial art who spoke English and was available in like 72 hours. The thing about martial arts instruction is that it's a very personal thing, and it's very, very responsibility heavy. If you're a martial arts teacher and you do something in class, everyone around you is going to think that it's the right thing to do. And, you know, since a lot of people see martial arts as like self-defense or like as, you know, stuff that's important to, you know, keep yourself safe and healthy, you really, really don't want to do the wrong thing because it'll get imitated. And it's been a while since I did that, you know, year of martial arts where I was terrible. I am less terrible now. I have an instructor's license because I spent the full year with them. I have a second degree black belt, but like, I am nowhere near a master teacher. I'll probably never be a master master teacher. And so if Jake Edelstein, representing this Hollywood effort, you know, wants me to teach someone who is famous, you know, immediately I'm thinking like, well, how can I put them in touch with a master level teacher? Because I'm not one. But then he was like, well, you know, we need to make sure that they speak English. We need to make sure that they're available, you know, very, very soon. And it needs to be this specific martial art. And, you know, my form of Aikido is not the biggest form of Aikido. It's a very, very minor, well, not a very minor form, but it's not the biggest one. So I was like, okay. And it turned into one of the most interesting weeks of my life that I don't know how much I can really say about it because, you know, again, it's a pretty personal endeavor to go into martial arts training. And, you know, at the time we couldn't talk about it because, you know, no one knew about Tokyo Bison. And now enough people do that the fact that I've said all this probably makes it somewhat easy for someone to figure out what I'm actually talking about. But yeah, it was one of the coolest experiences of my life because the people who we were working with made it clear that they wanted a very intense experience, perhaps close to the one that Jake himself went to when he was training with cops. And, you know, when I trained with Tokyo cops, you know, I learned very quickly that, like, they're pretty serious about what they do. And they're not just interested in how applications are supposed to work of techniques. Like, they want to see if stuff works for real. So they'll put real strength into these techniques. And, like, people get hurt. When I was at the dojo, someone fractured their tibia. A couple people had to be taken to the hospital because they were hyperventilating. During punching practice, I am not proud to say that I accidentally connected with a punch and caused one of the poor female police officers there to, you know, lose her wind for, like, you know, a good hour. She was having trouble breathing, and I felt so bad. I wound up getting her, like, a piece of cake as an apology, and she looked at me and she said, you know, Ben, like, it was really nice of you, but, like, I can't eat anything right now. Like my stomach isn't working. I'm like, oh, God. You know, it's a new experience for me for being able to actually hurt someone. But, like, that was the level at which we practiced that. And, you know, like, not hardcore, you know, like, MMA, you know, like, professional level, but, like, to the point where people really did get hurt. Not on purpose, but, like, no one was really seriously holding back. And that's the level at which we were allowed to train these folks from this production. And man, oh man, if they weren't really up to the task, I mean, I witnessed some really, really amazing stuff there. Stuff that I wasn't even sure I was capable of doing. But, you know, if I'm the teacher and I don't do it, then the student can't do it, so I have to do it. So I'm doing it, and I'm like, I can't believe I'm actually doing this. And then, you know, the other folks are doing it too, and I'm like, you know, what's happening here? Like, you know, this is really something magical. But I have so much admiration for that production, particularly from the initial director of the first episode, Michael Mann, whose work I've admired for a long time, but I really, really admire the work that he put in on this first episode just because of how intense he was about getting every little detail right. I mean, you talk about, like, you know, this intensity that I had when I was, you know, a nerd going up being like, oh yeah, I want to learn Japanese enough that I can play Final Fantasy V. Michael Mann put together a set that resembled 1990s Japan more than anything, you know, since that decade ended. You look at episode one and you're looking at a world that just doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, the Aikido scenes in that episode, I think, amounted to something like 45 seconds, if that. Maybe even closer to like 20. So they put in together all this work with me, so much intense work and pain, you know, sweat and tears.
You know, could have easily faked it, but...
Yeah, they didn't. I mean, that's all real.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. Good luck with the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the very first episode of this podcast. If you would like to hear more, please rate and review or send your thoughts directly through the podcast website. Thank you, and I hope you tune in to the next one.